So I'm reading from chapter 6. The novel is set in a futuristic, extropian Walt Disney World where there is no more scarcity. If you come to the keynote on Tuesday, you'll understand that this has become a theme in my life. And it begins with the protagonist, Julius, lying on his hotel bed, pondering the possibility that he might be insane. Lying on my hotel bed, mesmerized by the lazy turns of the ceiling fan, I pondered the possibility that I was nuts. It wasn't unheard of, even in the days of the bitchin' society, and even though there were cures, they weren't pleasant. I was once married to a crazy person. We were both about 70, and I was living for nothing but joy. Her name was Zoya, and I called her Zed. We met in orbit, where I'd gone to experience the famed low-gravity Sybarites. Getting staggering drunk is not much fun at 1G, but at 10 to the neg 8, it's a blast. You don't stagger, you bounce. And when you're bouncing in a sphere full of other bouncing, happy, boisterous, naked people, things get deeply fun. I was bouncing around inside a clear sphere that was a mile in diameter, filled with smaller spheres in which one could procure vaults of fruity, deadly concoctions. Musical instruments littered the sphere's floor, and if you knew how to play, you'd snag one, tether it to you, and start playing. Others would pick up their own axes and jam along. The tunes varied from terrific to awful, but they were always energetic. I had been working on my third symphony, off and on, and whenever I thought I had a nice bit nailed, I'd spend some time in the sphere, playing it. Sometimes, the strangers who jammed in gave me new and interesting lines of inquiry, and that was good. Even when they didn't, playing an instrument was a fast track to intriguing and interesting naked stranger. Which is how we met. She snagged a piano and pounded out barrel house runs in quirky time as I carried the main thread of the movement on a cello. At first it was irritating, but after a short while, I came to a dawning comprehension of what she was doing to my music, and it was really good. I'm a sucker for musicians. We brought the session to a crashing stop, me bowing furiously as spheres of perspiration beaded on my body and floated gracefully into the hydrotropic recyclers, she beating on the 88 like they were the perp who killed her partner. I collapsed dramatically as the last note crashed through the bubble. The singles, couples, and groups stopped in mid-flight coitus to applaud. She took a bow, untethered herself from the Steinway, and headed for the hatch. I coiled my legs up and did a fast burn through the sphere, desperate to reach the hatch before she did. I caught her as she was leaving. "Hey," I said, "that was great. I'm Julius. How are you doing?" She reached out with both hands and squeezed my nose and my unit simultaneously. Not hard, you understand, but playfully. "Honk," she said, and squirmed through the hatch while I gaped at my burgeoning chub on. I chased after her. "Wait," I called as she tumbled through the spoke of the station towards the gravity. She had a pianist's body. Pianist's body. Re-engineered, one of those words that's better on paper than it is aloud. Re-engineered arms and hands that stretched for impossible lengths, and she used them with a space hand's grace, vaulting herself forward at speed. I bumbled after her as best as I could on my freshman space legs, but by the time I reached the half-G rim of the station, she was gone. I didn't find her again until the next movement was done, and I went to the bubble to try it out on an oboe. I was just getting warmed up when she passed through the hatch and tied off to the piano. This time, I clamped the oboe under my arm and bobbed over to her before moistening the reed and blowing. I hovered over the piano's top, looking her in the eye as we jammed. Her mood that day was 4-4 time and 1-4-5 progressions, in a feel that swung around from blues to folk to rock, teasing at the edge of my own melodies. She noodled at me, I noodled back at her, and her eyes crinkled charmingly whenever I managed a smidge of tuneful wit. She was almost completely flat-chested, covered in a fine, red, downy fur like a chipmunk. It was a jaunter style, suited to the climate-controlled, soft-edged life in space. 50 years later, I was dating Lil, another redhead, but she was my first. I played and played, entranced by the fluidity of her movements at the keyboard, her comical moves of concentration when picking out a particularly picky little riff. When I got tired, I took it to a slow bridge or gave her a solo. I was going to make this last as long as I could. Meanwhile, I maneuvered my way between her and the hatch. When I blew the last note, I was as wrung out as a washcloth, but I summoned the energy to zip out over to the hatch and block it. She calmly untied and floated over to me. I looked in her eyes, silver, slanted cat eyes, eyes that had been that I'd been staring into all afternoon, and watched that smile that started at their corners and spread right down to her long, elegant toes. She looked back at me at length, then, at length, grabbed a hold of my joint again. "You'll do," she said, and led me to her sleeping quarters across the station. We didn't sleep. Zoya had been an early network engineer for the GeoSync broadband constellations that went up at the cusp of the world's ascent into bitchinry. She'd been exposed to a lot of hard rads and low G, and had generally become pretty transhuman as time went by, upgrading with a bewildering array of third-party enhancements, a vestigial tail, eyes that saw through most of the RF spectrum, her arms, her fur, her dog-leg reversible knee joints, and a completely mechanical spine that wasn't prone to any of the absolutely inane bullshit that plagues the rest of us, like lower back pain, intrascapular inflammation, sciatica, and slipped discs. I thought I lived for fun, but I didn't have anything on Zed. She only talked when honking and whistling and grabbing and kissing wouldn't do, and routinely slapped upgrades into herself on the basis of any whim that crossed her mind, like when she resolved to do a spacewalk bare-skinned and spent the afternoon getting tin-plated and iron-lunged. I fell in love with her 100 times a day and wanted to strangle her twice as often. She stayed on her spacewalk for a couple of days, floating around the bubble, making crazy faces in its mirrored exterior. She had no way of knowing if I was inside, but she assumed I was watching. Or maybe she didn't, and was making faces for anyone's benefit. But then she came back through the lock, strange and wordless, and her eyes full of the stars she'd seen, and her metallic skin cool with the breath of empty space. And she led me a merry game of tag through the station, the mess hall where we skipped sloppy through a wobbly ovoid of rice pudding, the greenhouses where she burrowed like a gopher and shinnied like a monkey, the living quarters in bubbles as we interrupted 1,000 acts of coitus. You'd have thought that we'd have followed it up with an act of our own, and truth be told, that was certainly my expectation when we started the game that I came to think of as the steeplechase, but we never did. Halfway through, I'd lose track of carnal urges and return to a state of childlike innocence, living only for the thrill of the chase and the giggly feeling I got whenever she found some new, ever more outrageous corner to turn. I think we became legendary on that station, that crazy pair that was always zipping in and zipping away, like having your party crashed by two naked co-ed Marx brothers. When I asked her to marry me, to return to Earth with me, to live with me until the universe's mainspring unwound, she laughed, honked my nose and my willy, and shouted, "You'll do!" I took her home to Toronto, and we took up residence 10 stories underground in an overflow residence for the university. Our woofie wasn't so hot Earthside. The endless institutional corridors made her feel at home while affording her endless opportunities for mischief. But bit by bit, the mischief dwindled, and she started talking more. At first, I admit I was relieved, glad that my strange, silent wife was finally acting normal, making nice with the neighbors instead of pranking them with endless honks and fanny kicks and squirt guns. We gave up the steeplechase and she had the dog legs taken out, her fur removed, her eyes unsilvered to a hazel that was as pretty and as fathomable as the silver had been inscrutable. We wore clothes. We entertained. I started to rehearse my symphony in low woofy halls and parks with any musicians I could drum up, and she came out and didn't play. Just sat to the side and smiled, with a smile that never went beyond her lips. She went nuts. She shat herself. She pulled her hair. She cut herself with knives. She accused me of plotting to kill her. She set fire to the neighbor's apartments, wrapped herself in plastic sheeting, dry-humped the furniture. She went nuts. She did it in broad strokes, painting the walls of our bedroom with her blood, jagging all night through rant after rant. I smiled and nodded and faced it for as long as I could, and then I grabbed her and hauled her, kicking like a mule, to the doctor's office on the second floor. She'd been dirtside for a year and nuts for a month, but it took me that long to face up to it. The doc diagnosed non-chemical dysfunction, which was by way of saying that it was her mind and not her brain that was broken. In other words, I'd driven her nuts. You can get counseling for non-functional, non-chemical dysfunction. Basically, try to talk it out, learn to feel better about yourself. She didn't want to. She was miserable, suicidal, murderous. In the brief moments of lucidity that she had under sedation, she consented to being restored from a backup that was made before we came to Toronto. I was at her side in the hospital when she woke up. I prepared a written synopsis of the events since her last backup for her, and she read it over the next couple of days. "Julius," she said while I was making breakfast in our subterranean apartment. She sounded so serious, so fun-free, that I knew immediately that the news would not be good. "Yes," I said, setting up plates of bacon and eggs, steaming cups of coffee. "I'm going back into space, and I'm going to revert to an older backup." She had a shoulder bag packed. She had her traveling clothes on. "Oh, shit." "Great," I said with forced cheerfulness, making a mental inventory of my responsibilities dirtside. "Give me a minute or two. I'll pack up. I miss space, too." She shook her head, and anger blazed in those utterly scrutable hazel eyes. "No, I'm going back to who I was before I met you." It hurt bad. I had loved the old steeplechase Zed, loved the fun and the mischief. The Zed she'd become after we wed was terrifying and terrible, but I'd stuck with her out of respect for the person she'd been. Now she was off to restore herself from a backup made before she met me. She was going to lop 18 months out of her life, start over again, and revert to a saved version. Hurt? It ached like a motherfucker. I went back to the station a month later and saw her jamming in the sphere with a guy who had three extra sets of arms depending from his hips. He scuttled around the sphere while she played a jig on the piano, and when her silver eyes lit on me, there wasn't a shred of recognition in them. She'd never met me. I died some too, putting the incident out of my head and sojourning to Disney World, there to reinvent myself with a new group of friends, a new career, a new life. I never spoke of Zed again, especially not to Lil, who hardly needed me to pollute her with remembrances of my crazy exes. How am I doing for time?
Just 20.
How much time have I got?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? I'll read one more scene and then I'll get off the stage. If I was nuts, it wasn't the kind of spectacular nuts that Zed had gone. It was a slow, seething, ugly nuts that had me alienating my friends, sabotaging my enemies, driving my girlfriend into my best friend's arms. I decided that I would see a doctor just as soon as we'd run the rehab past the ad hoc's general meeting. I had to get my priorities straight. I pulled on last night's clothes and walked out to the monorail station in the main lobby. The platform was jammed with happy guests, bright and cheerful and ready for a day of steady, hyper-mediated fun. I tried to make myself attend to them as individuals, but try as I might, they kept turning into a crowd, and I had to plant my feet firmly on the platform to keep from weaving among them to the edge, the better to snag a seat. The meeting was being held over in the Sunshine Tree Terrace in Adventureland, just steps from where I'd been turned into a road pizza by a still unidentified assassin. He's seeking out the person who killed him in the first chapter. The Adventureland ad hocs owed the Liberty Square crew a favor since my death had gone down on their turf, and so they had given us the use of their prize meeting room where the Florida sun streamed through the slats of the shutters, casting a hash of dust-filled shafts of light across the room. The faint sounds of the tiki drums and the spieling Jungle Cruise guides leaked through the room, a low-key ambient buzz from two of the park's oldest rides. There were almost 100 ad hocs in the Liberty Square crew, almost all second-generation cast members with big friendly smiles. They filled the room to capacity, and there was so much hugging and handshaking before the meeting came to order, I was thankful the room was too small for the de rigueur ad hoc circle of chairs, so that Lil was able to stand at a podium and command a smidge of respect. "Hi there," she said brightly. The weepy puffiness was still present around her eyes if you knew how to look for it, but she was an expert at putting on a brave face no matter what the ache. The ad hocs roared back a collective, "Hi, Lil," and laughed at their own corny tradition. Oh, they sure were a barrel of laughs at the Magic Kingdom. Everybody knows why we're here, right?" Lil said with a self-deprecating smile. She'd been lobbying hard for weeks. After all, they're arranging to redesign the Haunted Mansion. "Does anyone have any questions about the plans? We'd like to start executing right away." A guy with deliberately boyish, wholesome features put his arm in the air. Lil acknowledged him with a nod. "When you say right away, do you mean..." I cut in. "Tonight, after this meeting. We're on an 8-week production schedule, so the sooner we start, the sooner it'll be finished." The crowd murmured, unsettled. Lil shot me a withering look. I shrugged. Politics was not my game. Lil said, "Don, we're trying something new here, a really streamlined process. The good part is the process is short. In a couple months, we'll know if it's working for us. If it's not, hey, we can turn it around in a couple of months, too. That's why we're not spending as much time planning as we usually do. It won't take 5 years for the idea to prove out, so the risks are lower." Another cast member, a woman, a parrot 40, with a round, motherly demeanor, said, "I'm all for moving fast. Lord knows our pacing hasn't been all that hot. But I'm concerned about all these new people you propose to recruit. Won't having more people slow us down when it comes to making new decisions?" "No," I thought sourly, "because the people I'm bringing in aren't addicted to meetings." Lil nodded. "That's a good point, Lisa. The offer we're making to the telepresence players is probationary. They don't get to vote until after we've agreed that the rehab is a success." Another cast member stood. I recognized him, Dave, a heavy-set, self-important jerk who loved to work the front door even though he blew his spiel half the time. "Lillian," he said, smiling sadly at her, "I think you're really making a big mistake here. We love the mansion, all of us, and so do the guests. It's a piece of history, and we're its custodians, not its masters. Changing it like this, well," he shook his head, "it's not good stewardship. If the guests wanted to walk through a funhouse with guys jumping out of the shadows saying booga booga, they'd go to one of the Halloween houses in their hometowns. The mansion's better than that. I can't be a part of this plan." I wanted to knock the smug grin off his face. I delivered essentially the same polemic 1,000 times in reference to someone else's work, and hearing it from this jerk in reference to mine made me go all hot and red inside. Look, I said, if we don't do this, if we don't change things, they'll get changed for us, by someone else. The question is, Dave, whether a responsible custodian lets his custodianship be taken away from him, or whether he does everything he can to make sure he's still around to ensure that his charge is properly cared for. Good custodianship isn't sticking your head in the sand. I could tell I wasn't doing any good. The mood of the crowd was getting darker, the faces more set. I resolved not to speak again until the meeting was done, no matter what the provocation. Lil smoothed my remarks over and fielded a dozen more, and it looked like the objections would continue all afternoon and all night and the next day, and I felt woozy and overwrought and miserable all at the same time, staring at Lil and her harried smile and her nervous smoothing of her hair over her ears. Finally, she called the question. By tradition, the votes were collected in secret and publicly tabulated over the data channels. The group's eyes unfocused as they called up heads-up displays and watched the totals as they rolled in. I was offline and so unable to watch or vote. At length, Lil heaved a relieved sigh and smiled, dropping her hands behind her back. All right then, she said, over the crowd's buzz. Let's get to work. I stood up and saw Dan and Lil staring into each other's eyes, a meaningful glance between new lovers, and I saw red. Literally, my vision washed over pink, and a strobe pounded at the edges of it. I took two lumbering steps towards them and opened my mouth to say something horrible, but what came out was, wow! My right side went numb and my leg slipped out from under me and I crashed to the floor. The slatted light from the shutters cast its way across my chest as I struggled up with my left arm, and then it all went black.